This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, KenaiSeoul.net. This is the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Sabine Pooks. Most people know about the Kenai and Soldotna historical societies and museums. The town of Kasilof also has a very active historical association, and it's fitting since the area has such a rich history with a lot of fascinating families who came to the area pre-statehood. Several residents who were here in those early days have passed away in the last year. Few people know Kasilof's history better than Brent Johnson. He's the president of the Kasilof Regional Historical Association, and he joins us today on the Kenai Conversation. First things first, a lot of people refer to this area broadly as Kasilof and Clam Gulch, but there's also a lot of different ways to name the communities in the area, sometimes zooming in on very small sections of land, like Coho and Tustamina, as a sort of glossary. How do you talk about the communities in this area? Which of those names are we going to hear from you today?
Well, an easy divider between Kasilof and Coho is the Kasilof River. So basically, Coho is on the what we would refer to as the south side. It's actually the west side of the Kasilof River, and Kasilof is on the north side. Tustamina is that area that leads up to Tustamina Lake. And so there's a kind of a blend. People don't really know exactly where the boundaries are, but if you live on Tustamina Lake Road, you could consider yourself in Tustamina. And if you're on the other side of the road, of the Sterling Highway, and on that same side of the river, you're in Coho. Until you get down to South Coho, we're an interesting spot. Clam Gulch is that area between Falls Creek, or even the address Clam Gulch goes down as far as 10 miles north of Nanilchik, and then all the way up to South Coho. When we moved to the area in 1959, my parents said we lived in Clam Gulch, and I believed them. There was no Coho Loop Road, and so that's where we live. But now Coho Loop Road goes by my house, and my mailbox still says Clam Gulch on it, so I assume I live in Clam Gulch.
That's really interesting. How did the name Kasilof come to be?
It's a Russian word name, and nobody really knows the answer to that.
Gotcha.
Some people think... I was trying to think a doctor, thinks that it had to do with a word for gathering hay, something about grass, but that's not certain at all. It could very easily be a Russian surname.
Interesting. And then obviously Clam Gulch and Coho are easier to place kind of names.
Yeah, Coho, the Kasilof postmistress sort of chose Coho. She had suggested names and people helped her pick it, but the spelling is hers. It's a misspelling of the word. Fish, Coho.
And I'm sure we'll get into this later, but I was reading a bit about this history, and the post office plays such a huge role in the development of this area and the way that kind of these communities, came to be and centralized. I'm sure that will come up in our conversation. It's really interesting. I think a great place to kind of start talking about this history is you mentioned your family moving to the area. When did you come here and kind of walk us through what it was like at that time in the Kasilof area?
So my family moved up from Homer in 1959. I was born in Seldovia. And the area was way less houses, and there was way more moose. it was just a kind of a, as a kid, a wonderful country setting. It was a 2.25 mile walk to the school bus when I started going to school. And we had neighbors. Eventually, all of our neighbors moved away or died. And so we were all by ourselves for a little while. Then the area grew back up. In 1966, Coho Loop Road was built the rest of the way through. And then we got neighbors again that began to rent these old homestead houses that were built contemporary with when my parents built theirs.
What was the school situation at the time? Where were you going to school?
In Tustamina. Okay. Tustamina Elementary School. My siblings started in 1959, and that was the year in January of 1959 that Tustamina School opened. And but my siblings didn't start until the fall of 1959, so it was already open when they got here.
How many kids were in the school?
Not very many. gosh, I don't know the answer to that. I would guess it went grades 1 through 8, and I would guess that there was 10 kids per class, you know, so there might have been less than 80.
So what were your parents doing at that time?
My dad was a land surveyor. He started a private land surveying business in 1951 in Chugiak, Alaska. My sister was hit by a truck getting off the school bus and was killed. And so my parents moved to Homer in 1953. So my dad took his surveying business to Homer. Now, Homer was a fairly thriving community in 1953 with, you know, surveying business. But my mom was in love with the idea of getting free land by homesteading. So she sort of insisted on homesteading. And so that moved my dad's business from Homer, where there were customers, to Clam Culture, where there wasn't a phone. And so anyway, my dad continued being a land surveyor, and eventually business came around. My mom did a lot of things, one of which was staked out a SetNet site, and us kids and her became SetNetters. We were kind of the laughing stock of the beach, but anyway.
Why is that?
Well, because we didn't know what we were doing.
Were there a lot of SetNetters at that time?
Oh, sure. There had been a lot of SetNetters for years and years, back into the trap days. So traps were banned after the 1958 season, but long before that, there were SetNet sites between the traps. And so SetNetting started when commercial fishing started in 1882.
What was your parents' homesteading property like in Clam Gulch?
It was beautiful. That's why they picked the spot. It's on a little lake about a half mile long. So we had swimming and ice skating and trout fishing, and it was just a lot of spruce ends to hunt. We did that on our way to the bus, and put our guns underneath a tree and then hunt them again on the way home. And so anyway, it was beautiful. I grew up in a cabin that was 12 by 12 on the downstairs and 12 by 14 on the upstairs. And so it was a homestead shack. It's super embarrassing. but later on, you get over these things.
And there were how many people living in that?
Well, originally there was myself, my brother, and my sister, and my parents.
Gotcha.
My sister was there 3 years, I think, and then she went to school in Homer, so we didn't see her during the winters. And then she got married pretty quick after that. My brother joined the Navy after my freshman year. So I was sort of by myself after that.
So if you guys needed to kind of do a trip into town, what would that look like? What were sort of your outings into town, kind of given how the area was at the time?
It wasn't such a big deal. I mean, we had a car.
Yeah.
during the winter, there were some years we didn't plow our road. And so you would ski or walk out to the car, which was 2 miles away. Most of the years we did have the road plowed. And so, you know, sometimes it was an ordeal to get the car started. But I'm just telling you, it wasn't that big a deal. We went into town not that infrequently. We had a lot of ties in Homer because we had lived there, my family did, for 6 years, and my sister Gail continued to live there. She just moved out of Homer a couple of years ago, so she lived there from 1953 to like 2019 or something. And so we had a lot of ties to Homer, so lots of times we went that direction, but we didn't sell a lot. A few years ago, a friend of mine said, oh, we'll have to throw the chains on and come out and visit you. And I said, we go to town almost every day with no chains.
That's really funny. Are you still living on that property?
When Judy and I got married, my parents gave us 20 acres. And I had dreamed of moving to Oregon where they have plums growing right on trees. But 20 acres isn't something to walk away from. So we just hung it out here.
Wow. So we talked before, there's a lot of folks who kind of were in the area at that time and even before then who have kind of since passed away. There's actually a couple who passed away this year in 2021, and one of them is George Pollard. And anyone familiar with the area will know that there's a couple things named after the Pollard family in the area. They were really important in kind of making the area what we know it to be today. And on a broader scale, George Pollard's father, Dr. Pollard, was the only dentist in this part of the state when he was first here. So this is a really interesting family. They had a fox farm. it's such a kind of an interesting story. Did you know the Pollards when you were growing up in the area?
Yes, but you know, not that well. I mean, I knew him. I got to know George much later. We both went to the same church, and we had similar interests in history and whatnot. But yeah, sure, we knew him. When we first got there, they had Doc Pollard sent most of what was the herd that was in the Ninilchik State Fair was either from him or from the Presley Wilson family in Ninilchik. That yeah, and Doc Pollard, like you say, was a dentist. Everybody knew him. And Lucy Pollard has a super interesting history.
His wife.
Yes.
Can you give us a little snippet of her history?
Well, so Lucy was from Minnesota-ish area, and she went to the Baptist Children's Home on Woody Island in 1918. Mm-hmm. She showed up just before the Spanish flu hit. And so virtually everybody in the orphanage was sick. She went to join the orphanage to help, you know, be a mother, whatever you call those people that work at orphanages. Mm-hmm. And so she had to milk the cows and take care of the animals while everybody was sick. And so I contacted them a few years ago, and they had a really neat write-up from way back that they sent me with pictures.
Really?
And George hadn't seen a lot of those pictures, and he was really appreciated it.
Wow.
But yeah, so she was a little bit of a hero there. And that's, of course, how they met. Doc Pollard was had a contract with the territory to take care of this orphanage, apparently, as far as dental work. And so that's how they met.
Hmm. And you said this was on Woody Island?
Woody Island's right next to the city of Kodiak.
Wow. Wow. So how did they come to this part of the state?
So they didn't. They Lucy married Clayton. That guy, that's his dad's name, I think.
Clayton.
Yeah, Clayton in Anchorage in like 1924-ish. I would say about 1924.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had two children there, and the children went through school, you know, George and his brother Clayton. And then way back then, though, Dr. Pollard was always interested in farming. And so he had a fur farm in Anchorage. I think it was on M Street, one of the two. Anyway, they had a bunch of partners in that fur farm. In Kasilof, Perry Cole had a fur farm. Mm-hmm. And so Doc Pollard and Perry Cole were acquainted through fur farm. And Perry Cole was the animal inspector, your fur farm inspector for whoever, you know, did these fur farms.
Huh.
And so then eventually Pollard's group of investors invested in Perry's fur farm.
Mm-hmm.
So they got in that way, and then they started visiting Kasilof, and pretty soon they built a little shack on the property, and then eventually they bought out Perry Cole entirely.
So the fur farm, which is, I will say, a tongue twister, fur farm, is what brought the Pollards to Kasilof, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So how did he have time to have a fur farm and also to be this kind of enterprising dentist in the state?
Yeah, I have no idea how he found time to do all these things, and a politician, too. So,
politician?
Clayton Pollard was elected to the Alaska legislature. In fact, even after he moved to Kasilof, he got reelected to the Alaska legislature, which is a feat.
Some people just have more hours in the day than others. I don't understand how that's even possible.
Yeah.
So George and his brother Clayton Jr., grew up on this fur farm.
Well, they grew up in Anchorage, and they didn't move full-time to Kasilof until they graduated from high school. Pollards didn't move full-time to Kasilof. I would put it at 1945-ish. I think that's the year George graduated from high school that Pollard's moved to Kasilof.
Gotcha. And so, you know, what was it like kind of at, what do we know about what it was like at that time in the area? Because you had mentioned how kind of rural it was for you when you came, and that was even a couple years after this. So,
well, it was a huge difference between then and now, as there was no road connecting Anchorage with anything on the peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
There was a road from the cannery at the mouth of the Kasilof River up to Perry Cole's place, which became Pollard's place.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a 7-mile, and when we say dirt road, it was really a dirt road. Just like our Homestead Road was a dirt road, it irks me when people say, oh, we live on a dirt road when it's gravel and you can drive it 12 months out of the year.
You don't know what a real dirt road is.
Exactly. If you're not syncing up to your axles, it's not a dirt road. But anyway, so they had that one road. I got a hold of a guy, his name was Bud, and his last name is escaping me. when I was writing some history about George Pollard. And this guy was so special because he had come down as a junior high-ish kid and spent summers with George from Anchorage. And so he gave me a whole bunch of details about George, and it all matched perfectly with everything else I knew about George. And so, I don't know, historians love that when things actually match.
Yeah, sure. And you get a little bit of flavor of the... So what was George like?
Oh, George was one of those guys that everybody liked. He was just honest. I would say he was opinionated in some ways. He wasn't afraid to be against aerial wolf hunting, for instance, when maybe a lot of other people just don't like wolves. Mm. But George was just super knowledgeable, and he was a super caring husband. He married Ruth, and Ruth's sister Mary homesteaded right next to my wife's parents. Mm. And so their nephew, Dick Hawkins, is a friend of ours that still lives right there next to where
cool.
Judy's sister lives, or sisters live. But anyway, Ruth got Alzheimer's disease and dementia, and George took care of her in her house for probably over 10 years before she died. Mm. And so that tells me all kinds of love. But he was just a caring, great guy that everybody liked.
And they homesteaded themselves in...
Yes.
1959.
Okay, I would have put it a couple years before that, but 59, I'll believe you.
Sure, sure. And he was a full-time guide and outfitter.
Yes.
So what was that business like? What did that look like for him?
Well, I mean, I'm not super familiar. I know Larry Meyer is an old-timer historian that passed away a few years ago, and he worked for George for a while guiding. A lot of people came to know George through guiding and through his connection with Tustamy Lake. Now, George would take people sheep hunting or moose hunting or bear hunting, but eventually he mostly took people camera hunting, as I understand it. He kind of segued into his final days to mostly taking people to just look at things and to take pictures.
But where'd they go?
Tustamy Lake.
Okay.
Yeah, he's the expert Tustamy Lake guy. Mm. And so many of the people that came to know him along those lines. You know, there'd be Jim Taylor as a Tustamy Lake part-time dweller these days, who was a good friend of George's, or Clark Fair, who wrote history, and just so many of the Let's Rings, you know, everybody that goes up to Tustamy Lake knew George.
Hmm.
He was into horses, too, so that's another connection, like the Fritz family, they're all into horses, and so, you know, the horse connection is big for people that do horses.
Hmm.
Like, my wife's parents would have been horse people.
Oh, how interesting. The Pollard family seemed to be really important in kind of shaping this area. Yeah, at this time, I mean, how would you kind of characterize the impact they had on this part of the peninsula?
So it was super important. They were some of the people that started Kisilov Community Church. And before they did that, there were two missionaries that moved to Kisilov about the same time that Pollard's did, and about the same times that the Feller Schultz family moved there. And so those people are the ones that began having home meetings with these two women missionaries, Florence Dalbo and Gladys Erdman were the two missionaries. They would hold the services, and they would either do it in Wayne Feller's house or in Pollard's house, mostly in Wayne Feller's house.
Hmm.
And Fellers bought... the name is escaping. Oh, Sandwick's, John Sandwick's Fox Farm. And it was a beautiful house, really spectacular.
Hmm. Wow. What made this area so prime for fox farming?
So the Kisilov River made it the prime for fox farming because it provided some of the food. When you read, the people were always hunting porcupine for their foxes, but I just know they hunted a lot of salmon right out of that river for their foxes. So... the area was homesteaded because the federal government did surveying in the area.
Mm.
So in the 1918, 1919, 1920, they had the sections laid out. And a guy named Featherton Williamson, or Billy Williamson is what his nickname was.
Featherton?
Yeah. Was the head of one of these survey crews. And so they put in lots of section corners and quarter corners. And then Pete Jensen and Pete Madsen were on his survey team. All of those people became fox farmers on the Kisilov River. So when my theory is when they were surveying, the price of fox furs was booming. And so they said, hey, wouldn't this be a great place to start a fox farm? And so all of them did. And then there were several others that joined simultaneously about. And so that was why Kisilov was such a big fox farming area. Huh. It was because Kisilov River provided transportation, and it provided some salmon, I think, for the foxes. And yeah.
Wow. So it sounds like the industry in the area at the time, there was fishing, mm-hmm. there was fox farming. Mm-hmm. Anything else we're missing?
Well, not until oil came. There was big game guiding. Mm. So that goes way back into the 30s at least. Mm. I'm not sure exactly when, but by the 30s for sure, they were taking big game guides up to Tustamina Lake. Mm.
And when these guys all needed their teeth fixed or cleaned, they would go to George's dad, Clayton, who was the only dentist in the area. Mm-hmm. Not to jump back in time or to kind of mess up the chronology here, but I think we'd be remiss to not talk about Dr. Clayton Pollard a little bit, because he was such an interesting character as well. What did his business look like? Would he travel around the peninsula to see people? Did he have a home office? What did that look like?
So when he moved to Kisilov, he was technically trying to become a farmer and trying to get out of being a dentist, I think. And so when you went to Dr. Pollard, it's because you needed to go see him. And when you mentioned teeth cleaning, I doubt he ever cleaned a tooth. He pulled teeth and he filled teeth. And I talked to a lot of people who've had that done, and some had fairly rosy experiences. Mrs. Schultz, which was Elizabeth Feller's daughter, Martha Schultz, she had all of her teeth pulled. And when I say all, I hope I'm using that word correctly. I don't really know, but that's what her diary says.
Okay.
And she had false teeth made by Dr. Pollard here in Kisilov. And I don't know how that happened. Maybe they sent away for him. I don't really know. All I know is she was miserable with him. She never said a bad word about Dr. Pollard, though, because everybody loved Dr. Pollard, including them, especially. And especially because he was part of the Christian part of the community. Mm. And so I think that was one of the reasons. But eventually she flew out to the States and got her teeth redone.
Okay. Sounds like that was maybe a good move.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And you talk about this sense of community. What were kind of the focal points of the community? It sounds like the church was a big one.
Beginning in 1953, the church was one, but you would have to say that Heckel's store, which was eventually bought by Lefty Miller, that's where the post office was, and so that's got to have been a focal point. The cannery was a big focal point, but the cannery closed down like 1922. So there was a boom during World War I for canneries, and they made a lot of money. And then shortly after that, they lost a lot of money. And so the canneries, Alaska Packers Association began to consolidate canneries. And by that, I mean they would buy up a bunch of them and close most of them and then have a much more efficient operation out of just one. Mm. So there was a lot of cannery closures. And even though the Kisilov cannery started first in 1882, and I don't think it was until 1888 that a cannery started in Kenai, eventually by 1927, the Kisilov cannery closed to never open again. And so it was still a kind of a focal point, just because people stole lumber out of it. They moved the cannery, sold the school building in 1938. It was the hospital at the cannery, and they moved it up to where it is. Well, they moved it to the airport, which then got moved to today. It's the McLean Center, our museum at our historical society. But it started as the hospital at the cannery, and the people who moved it cut it into three pieces and moved it, which blows my mind. Because,
oh my goodness.
Like, we've got a fabulous cabin crew at our museum, and they build things. But when they move buildings, they lots of times take the logs apart one by one and then number them and then put the logs back together, which is easier in a way than trying to move a building by cutting it into three pieces.
Wow.
I think. I don't know.
I would have to agree based on how that sounds. And you mentioned before, you know, how the dirt roads, and when did the highway come in? When did it?
About 1948.
Okay.
That's when the bridge, Kosilov Bridge, was laid in 1948. I don't think the highway was dedicated until 1950, but it arrived at Kosilov in 1948.
Hmm. How did that change things?
Oh, I mean, it changed things like, I was born in Soldovia because Homer didn't have a hospital. Mm-hmm. And once it got connected to the road system, then growth became exponential. And a city like Soldovia, which had been one of the most thriving cities, has become a dwarf city. Mm-hmm. It just withered. Mm-hmm. And it's still that way today. I mean, there's a lot of activity and stuff in Soldovia, and I admire them and whatnot. And it's the prettiest place in the world, but still they suffer from not being connected to a road system.
Hmm.
So the road system, you got to have mail that went by the road, whereas before it went by dog team and people that walked up and down the beach or by boat in the summer.
Hmm.
And all of a sudden you had groceries that came in to Seward, and then they would get trucked down. Walt Christensen ran a truck from Seward to Homer daily in the early years. And
wow. So you mentioned Soldovia being cut off from the road system. So I guess the converse of that is that a community like Kosilov that is then kind of put smack dab onto the road system, was there a population boom after that as well?
There was a population boom after World War II, which coincided with this development.
I see.
And so it's hard to define. But there was a kind of a cannery boom after that period of time, too. So anyway, yeah.
So you mentioned the post office, and you also mentioned Hickel's store. And I assume Hickel is the same family as Isabel Hickel, who was... I'm trying not to jump too much around here, but there's so many interesting people who I want to talk about. So Isabel Hickel was an early Kosilov postmaster.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned before we started recording that a lot of the early postmasters in this area were women.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, Bev Christensen was the Clam Gulch postmistress, and it went from Mrs. Hickel, Isabel Hickel, to Mrs. Miller at the one in Kosilov. Then I'm trying to think, Frieda Lewis was the postmaster at Coho, and she was the only postmaster they ever had at Coho, other than she had people fill in and help her. And so, it was a lot of women. And so one of the things I did when I was researching for Snapshots at Stakehood is I got a hold of the National Archive for the Post Office, and I got a microfilm of all the post offices in Alaska and all the postmasters and the date that they were. And so as you look back at all of these various people who've been postmasters, it's pretty common to have a woman be the postmaster while a man, because she can maybe stay home while the man is off fishing or doing something else.
So. That's really interesting. And you mentioned Coho. What were the post offices in the area?
So there was Kosilov, which has moved around a number of different times. It went, it was in a different location, and then it was at Hickel's, which is on Olympia Drive across from the museum.
Okay.
And then it moved to Kosilov Grocery and was there with the Galloways for a number of years.
Huh.
And then it moved to its current location where it is now.
Mm.
The one in Coho stayed where it's at. And I think Frieda started it in 1950, and she was there for 10-ish years, maybe 15. I can't remember for sure.
Mm.
The one in Clam Gulch started with... I think the Osmers might have started it, and then Christensen bought the Clam Gulch store, it was called, which kind of came with the post office. They had it for years. Then when they retired, the post office actually moved to the house that Jackson's built, which is, I'll call it, half a mile north of where the Clam Gulch store was. And then that building that is specifically a post office was built, and it got moved there.
How important is having a post office to the development of a community.
So there's just a couple of things. There is a school, which is super important, and then there's a post office. People have to have a way to communicate, and when they communicate, you can put up notices, voting, all this sort of thing. It kind of coordinates with post offices in days a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And so post offices give an opportunity for people to come together because they're going to get their mail. And lots of times in the old days, they would give letters to somebody else that, hey, you go and buy so-and-so's and, you know, here's their mail. And anyway, post offices were super important. And I think they're still important. It's a shame that the Coho Post Office closed and that the Clam Gulch Post Office is on micro hours. But anyway, that's the way it is. Everybody's got to make budgets work too. But yeah, so post offices were real important. They were more important in the early days. The one at Kasilof was unique because it was they had the airport and people would go and get the mail off the airplane when it landed, and they never knew for sure whether or not the airplane was going to land. And so it was something they had to observe that the airplane was landing.
Oh, why is that?
Well, because let's say the airplane was supposed to come. So I have the diary that I told you about.
Sure.
And the Wayne Fellers was one of the people for a while, Archie McLean did it for a while, that got the mail off the plane. And the plane in those days, I mean, it was an airport that was barely kept up and the weather was horrible and they didn't have the instrumentation they have today. And so basically the plane would buzz somebody's house and land and it had to work out. And so you had to go get the mail then, you know. They did build a little building. I forgot what we call it. We have it over at the museum now for people to stand in at the airport because sometimes In the diary, people would talk about going and standing in the building endlessly and then, you know, the airplane not coming and they would say, oh, I guess we're not going today.
Oh, my goodness. And so I imagine these were a lot of homesteaders who were probably trying to keep in touch with their families back in the lower 48, right?
Oh, for sure. And in touch with their families. And then everybody ordered through Sears or Montgomery Wards or whatever. So that's how, even growing up, that's how we got our clothes. We didn't go in and shop at the fancy places in town. We would order them through the catalog. But more so before the highway came, more so.